Accession number 29075, Reel 6.
Graham Meredith, Reel 6. Could you talk a little more about the role of the flight deck officer?
The flight deck on the back of a frigate is quite small, and it has to have a team of people who will run it in order to be able to receive and dispatch the helicopters. And the whole staffing of it was provided from a variety of departments within the ship, nothing to do with the Fleet Air Arm or with the helicopter itself. There was a small flight of a small team of flight engineers, but they weren't responsible for running the flight deck. The flight deck officer really was running a crew of at least four on watch of men to tie the boat down using lashings, plus a couple of firefighters who were all got up in Fiat-Nort suits and had a thoroughly uncomfortable time when we were in hot weather. And the main task was to be available, often at very short notice, and things would be going on around the ship in the normal way of things. And well, on one occasion we were called out and we had the helicopter down on deck in 4 minutes from the thing being piped from the bridge. We'd all got there and done it. So it needed to be organised to that was a very good thing that we did on that occasion, because the aircraft had an emergency and was able to be recovered onto a hard deck rather than splashing into the sea. And then it was helicoptered off. It was taken away by a crane when we got in harbour. We didn't have our own flight after the workup at Portland. And so we were really a facility deck rather than the home deck for a particular helicopter. That was because I don't think they got enough to go around, and they decided that we would not have one. We did carry one for several weeks at a time when we were out in the Far East, but not all the time. And the principal job of the flight deck officer was to signal by waving the arms in prescribed manners to the pilot as he was coming in down flight path on the port quarter, and bring him into the hover off to the left to the port side of the ship, and then tell him to come over so that he's over the centre of the deck, then wave him down and tell him to shut down when he was just clear of the deck, so that he didn't land too hard. And of course, if the deck is heaving, that has to be judged fairly carefully. The oleos of the helicopter could take quite a bit of a drop, but you didn't want to have the helicopter dropping to the bottom of the wave, so to speak. You tried to catch it at the top and then lash it on very, very quickly. And then for launching, of course, starting the thing up, making sure all the checks were done, and then telling the pilot when he could go and away he would go. He was obviously in charge of his own aircraft, but what one was doing was advising him on what to do rather than actually telling him. It was all a part of the ship's efficiency, and was a fun task to have. And in many ships, it was the supply officer who did it, but not always.
Did that then conflict with what you had to do as a supply officer?
Generally, no, unless, as I said earlier, you left a lot of money lying around somewhere than you had to. secure that and rush down to do the job. But no, it didn't.
Whose responsibility was it to decide whether conditions were too rough or...
Well, finally, it would be the captain, but the officer of the watch, as advised by the flight deck officer. If the if the flight deck officer was unhappy, or indeed the pilot of the helicopter, then they would feed in their concerns to the officer of the watch. The officer of the watch is the captain's decision up on the bridge.
So, after your period aboard Cleopatra,
then my next job, I was to go back to the Admiralty, which was now called the Ministry of Defence, and of course it would actually meant working in the Ministry of Defence building rather than the Admiralty building in Whitehall, a much less gracious environment than we had before. And I was to become the Assistant Secretary to the First Sea Lord. Very much the same job as I'd done for the Vice Chief of the Naval Staff, but at a higher level, more inter-service work. We did actually have two Assistant Secretaries in First Sea Lord's office. One did the Royal Navy and the personal side of the Admiral's programme, and the other one did the inter-service side, all the committee work and that sort of thing, and making sure that all the papers were right and that our naval comments were were submitted on time, keeping up to deadlines and that sort of thing. I had the Admiralty desk for the first 6 months or so of my time, and then I moved across into doing the inter-service work. We called it the Chiefs of Staff work. And my two First Sea Lords were, the first one was Sir Varel Begg, who was, I think, quite the strongest man I've ever known. Not a man of huge stature, physically, but by Jove, he was tough. And if you wanted him to go without sleep for 3 or 4 days, he'd go without sleep for 3 or 4 days. And then he'd go out and play a game of tennis. He played the meanest and hardest game of tennis outside the Wimbledon Championship you'd ever see. He had become the First Sea Lord, which he was due to do anyway, when Admiral Luce resigned after the publication of Dennis Healy's Defence Review, which abolished the carriers for the Navy. And Admiral Luce was the one member of the Admiralty Board who, the naval members of the Admiralty Board who resigned. And so did the Navy Minister, Christopher Mayhew. And Varel Begg was then brought in at short order from being Commander-in-Chief Portsmouth up to being the First Sea Lord. And it was a very difficult position for him to be in, because he had accepted the post at all and came into office. The Fleet Air Arm, which of course felt terribly let down by the outcome of the Defence Review, which they also felt was due to ineffective work by the naval staff, the Fleet Air Arm then vilified Varel Begg, or many of them did, because they thought he had betrayed the trust by even accepting the job of First Sea Lord. So who was going to be First Sea Lord? I mean, was the subsidiary question. You know, somebody was going to have to do it, or the Navy was going to vanish. It was a thoroughly unreasonable situation, but there was a great deal of rumbling going on among the Fleet Air Arm in particular, but also other parts of the Navy who were unhappy that we had lost out in that Defence Review. And Varel Begg came in and he had to first of all work within the political realities that had been dictated by Dennis Healy and Harold Wilson as the Prime Minister, and at the same time rescue whatever he could from the embers of this review. And the withdrawal from the Far East was one of the key things that this review dictated. It did, of course, take several years to achieve that withdrawal from the Far East, because that didn't happen until the end of 1971. But Verelbeg rode out this storm, and he established the thing called the Future Fleet Working Party, which then designed the shape of the Navy 10 years hence. It takes time to get from where you are, particularly if there's something wrong with it, into what is going to be right for the future. And it was he who, very privately, quite secretly, set going the work for what came to be called the through-deck cruiser. But that was never given any publicity at all during Verelbeg's time as the first Sea Lord. It was when his successor came in that he was able to pull the wraps aside and say, look what we could have in the future. And then he fought the battle through to get the through-deck cruisers, which are the invincible class. And he was very prescient and quite determined and strong as to how that was to be achieved. And he actually left a substantial good legacy for the Navy with plans to take us on through into the 70s and 80s. The time we're talking about, you see, is 1967. He was 66 to 68. He was the first Sea Lord. And it was mainly the internal Whitehall battle, which was, curiously, it was not a battle between the services. It was, although the Air Force had stepped way out of line in the Healy Defence Review, the Chief of the Air Staff was Sir John Grandy, and he and Verelbeg got on very well. They didn't always agree, of course. But the services were standing pretty united in each other's support, providing the support was worth giving. But the main problem was with the politicians and the civil servants and the Treasury approach and that sort of thing. And Verelbeg proved to be very, very canny in the way he conducted the battles there. There's one particular thing I remember. We were talking about the future nuclear submarines, SSNs, not the Polaris submarines. And the Navy had been pitching for, I think it was 18 hulls that we should have. And the money men had been pitching for 11 or 12. And eventually, I took the message from Healy's office that Healy was going to approve. So in other words, if we wanted to get up and scream, we... the First Sea Lord would have pounded along the corridor, that he was going to approve the mid-teens. Well, that's, you think, oh well, that's 15, that's not very, but Verelbeg quickly worked it out. It was the mid between 13 and 19, and that was 16, and he said, that'll do. Of course, there had obviously been a calculation as to what our minimum level would be, but he, the way he had presented the case, both openly and officially, and indeed privately to Dennis Healy, actually that got us our the figure of the SSNs that we wanted, and he retired 1 year after I'd got there to work in his office, and he went off to become the governor of Gibraltar. Not a job that he had particularly wanted to do. He did have another possible plan in his life, which didn't happen, because the government put pressure on him to become the governor of Gibraltar. And of course he got there, and then set about reorganizing the garrison and the defending of Gibraltar, which was a good thing because we were about to go through another bad spell with Spain on Gibraltar. His successor as First Sea Lord was a very different character, Sir Michael Lefanu, known throughout the Navy as Lef, the Chinese Admiral, Li Fan Yu, and things like that, and also Ginger, because he was red-headed. He was a much more mercurial character, a lot of fun about him, and oh so bright. He could have conversations in Greek and Latin with learned people, but he was also very quick on the uptake. Both of them were men of very high intellect, and I think I found that very reassuring, both my experience with Caspar John nearly 10 years before, and with those two, to see that people of very high caliber, you know, can get through to the top. And they haven't always been of such high caliber, I have to say, but those two, Begg and Lefanu, certainly were. Lefanu was much more of a people person than Varel Begg, and he was very good, you know, on the sort of publicising and doing things that were going to motivate people. There was a nice story that not long after he became the First Sea Lord, he had arranged that he would form part of the air crew ferrying some buccaneers out from Lossiemouth to the Far East, and that they would be taken on board HMS Hermes, I think it was. Anyway, it was a Captain Parker was the captain. And Lef rode in the back seat and did actually do the navigation bit and so on. And as these aircraft were in the circuit to come and land on the carrier, the commander of the Far East Fleet, who was Admiral Bill O'Brien, turned to Captain Parker and said to him, "Oh, the observer in the lead aircraft is the First Sea Lord." I would have loved to have been there to see that moment. But, of course, that gets around. And it's a real shot in the arm for people's morale and that sort of thing. And Lef was out there for a few days, and then he flew back to England. Lefanu was the one who, as it were, produced to the world the plan for the see-through cruiser, or the through-deck cruiser, the Invincible class, for which he was virtually elected to sainthood by the Fleet Air Arm. And he did a lot, really, for the Navy's morale at what had been really quite a bad time. We were coming up for another redundancy programme, which is always somewhat unsettling to folk. And but then the one thing for which I suppose he'll be most remembered was the abolition of the tot, the daily ration of rum. Various people had addressed this in recent years because it was such an anachronism, and where it was fine for the days of pulling on ropes in heavy seas and things like that, dealing with screwdrivers in fancy electronics, the tot was not a good idea. And Lef was willing to bite the bullet, and then took the rest of the Navy Board, the Admiralty Board, with him. And the tot was abolished in April 1970, I suppose. And he will always be remembered for that, but not remembered badly. People, I think nearly everybody reckons it was long overdue, but nevertheless he was the one who took that decision.
It wasn't poorly received by the by the
it wasn't what?
It wasn't poorly received by the
oh, initially it was poorly received by a certain a certain number, particularly of the sailors and senior rates, whose sort of daily social life revolved around it. But many, many realised that it was the right thing to do. And there was never any problem with it. Yeah, it was mainly a grumbling campaign, which didn't get taken very far anyway.
What were your own feelings about the Defence Review?
The Healy Defence Review? Probably that it was becoming inevitable. What I, at that time, thought was particularly questionable was where defence was coming in the national priorities, because it was from that point onwards that defence and overseas matters were relegated to a minor role in government expenditure, and the social expenditure, the National Health Service and that sort of thing gained primacy, and one could see that at that time. And you know, brought up with the, you know, what one had lived through and what one's parents had lived through, it was pretty doubtful whether that was a wise thing to do. I mean, many of us did not expect that the Third World War, if it happened, was going to happen across the plains of Germany. The Cold War had got everybody really in a stalemate situation. If anything was going to happen, it was going to happen on the fringes. But the real touch paper for the future, in my view and others, was the Middle East, not necessarily knowing how it was going to blow. And of course, events of recent years have shown this to be the case. And we don't now have the resources to be able to protect British interests properly, or to deal with the situation. Mind you, you could argue whether whether we should have the resources in the first place. America's got them. Look how they've misused them in Iraq at the moment. But the, you know, I suppose for me, that 1966 Defence Review, the loss of the replacement carrier, which was a certain icon as far as many of the Navy were concerned, although we several of us thought that we were putting in an unduly large amount of resources into that program. And the withdrawal, the ultimate withdrawal from the Far East, seemed, well, we're going to diminish Britain, we're going to diminish the Navy, and was it going to be worthwhile for the future? And I think many of us didn't realise just how much resource was being put into the Polaris programme, because that, of course, was now developing, and the capital ships of the future were the big Polaris submarines and the SSNs, and this wasn't necessarily what we recognised. I did come to that quite quickly, to understand that, when I was the first Sea Lord. But the Healy Defence Review was announced while I was in the Cleopatra, and it took a little while, really, to take it in. The things that particularly irked us about the Defence Review, though, was the sleight of hand which moved Australia on the globe so as to demonstrate that aircraft could, land-based aircraft could cover all the areas of interest and that sort of thing. You know, that was basically dishonest. Now, whether that was political or it was done by the Air Force, I don't know. But it was something that upset the Navy one huge bit.
Can you comment on how, I suppose using the example of the SSNs, how the number of replacements the unit was reached, and the element of strategic necessity or any self-preservation within the Navy was prevalent.
It's very difficult. It's an interwoven thing. I'm sure there was an element of self-preservation, trying to keep the best Navy, the biggest Navy possible. There has, for the last 50 years, been an argument which has gone on and off, of whether we should have cheaper second-class ships and then some really first-class ships. And the attitude that won was we must have all our ships must be highly capable, must be able to do anything that they might be anywhere. I haven't always gone along with that, and having served in the Type 14 frigate and coastal minesweepers, they saved the Navy's reputation, saved its bacon in the 1950s and 60s, those little ships. And they were produced by the dozen pretty well, and very cheaply, and they enabled us to spread the Navy's influence into all sorts of places very economically. Because the difficulty is, if you employ a frigate with a crew of 250 or something into a job, Cyprus Patrol and that sort of thing, it's much more than you need. It's much more expensive. You can do the job with a very much smaller thing. In fact, probably nowadays you could do it with an unmanned, pilotless aircraft. At that time, those two classes of ships, which were the second class Navy, were invaluable to the Navy's reputation, and they gave lots of good command and more experience to more junior officers. They had larger degrees of responsibility in a smaller vessel than if they had been in the conventional size of a frigate. How we arrived at the numbers, I can't remember now. And of course, I wasn't actually doing those sort of calculations. But Plans Division has always tackled this and related the requirement to to the number of ships. Well, the task that's got to be performed to the numbers of ships. But wanting as many as they can squeeze out of the available money.